Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer at WNYC from the Aspen Ideas Festival today. Good morning again, everyone. And we are delighted to have with us now President Obama's U.S. Education Secretary, Arne Duncan. He was previously the school superintendent in Chicago, as some of you know. Secretary Duncan, so nice of you to do this. Thanks for coming on with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Now, we are at an Ideas Festival, so let's get right to what might be the most radical idea that you're bringing to Washington. National standards, to do away with the mishmash of state and local education standards that we have around the country. Do you want national standards?
Well, let me correct you slightly. What I want is internationally benchmarked standards, and maybe I'll sort of walk through why I think this is important. One of the, I don't know whether it was an intended or unintended consequence of No Child Left Behind, is you had 50 different states setting their own standards, 50 different bars, 50 different goalposts. And due to political pressure in many states, including the state I'm from, Illinois, those standards got dummied down. And what I most worry about is in many places, I honestly think we're lying to children. Let me explain why. When a child or a parent hears that they are, quote unquote, meeting a state standard, I think the logical assumption is that they're on track to be successful. But in far too many places, children that are, you know, meeting a state standard are barely able to graduate from high school and are totally inadequately prepared to go to a competitive university, let alone graduate. So what we're advocating for is common college-ready, career-ready, internationally benchmarked standards. Our children today aren't competing for jobs down the block or in the district or in the state. They're competing for jobs with children in India and China. What's been fascinating is the push for this is not coming from us. It's really coming from the states. And states realize what they're doing isn't working, isn't in the best interest of their children, isn't in the best interest of their state's economy. And so governors and state school chiefs have rallied behind this, as you well know. 46 states have signed on to commit to work together to reaching this higher bar. And so this used to be the third rail. It used to be the kind of thing you couldn't talk about. But this is really an idea whose time has come, and we couldn't be more pleased with that.
Well, you know the old joke. Republicans will never go for national standards because they don't like anything national. Democrats won't go for it because they don't like standards. Do you think
it's a new day?
Right. Is it too much of a stereotype of both sides? Do you think there's some truth to the politics of it?
Well, what I'll tell you is that this is nothing. What we're doing is nothing to do with politics. This is absolutely bipartisan. This is being led by Democratic governors, Republican governors, state school chiefs, and actually the coalition is broader than this. The business community's been crying out for this for a long time. The leading nonprofits, the philanthropic sector, Gates Foundation, College Board, Achieve are all behind this. And very interestingly, in the past two to three months, both national unions, the AFT and the NEA, have all come on board. So you have this fascinating coalition of governors, business leaders, state school chiefs, unions, nonprofits, all saying this is the right thing to do. So whatever the past battles were, I'm not big on laying blame, whatever the past issues were, we're at a very different place today.
You used a word that I was going to challenge you to use, which is the word lie. And that is to say that the national standards that would be set under internationally consistent guidelines would tell us that a lot of students who are passing state and local standardized tests really are failing in ways that matter. So what are we parents supposed to make of this in the meantime? When my kids come home from their New York City public schools with, you know, grade X on the standardized tests, and I say, good job, am I supposed to say, I don't know if you're doing a good job?
What bothers me most is we have far too many students who work hard, who do the right thing, who think they're on track to be successful, and they get to junior year and senior in high school and they take the ACT or they take the SAT and they get this rude awakening that they were nowhere near as prepared as they thought they were.
Those are real, ACT and SAT.
Yeah, yeah. And so what I think we need to do is we need to be able to tell every 8-year-old, every 10-year-old, every 12-year-old, this is your strengths, this is your weaknesses, and this is what we have to work on together to help you be successful. And so when you prepare to go to college, you know, when you're a junior, senior in high school, There should be no surprises at that point. What this is going to take, as you know, Brian, this is going to take real political courage, because you're right. In many states, results today that are artificially high are going to drop. And so we have to make sure we give those governors the political courage, we support them, and we give them the cover they need to do the right thing, to take that short-term hit, to do the right thing long-term, both for children and for their state and for their state's economy.
Education Secretary Arne Duncan, my guest on WNYC at the Aspen Ideas Festival. Can you critique New York City or New Jersey, particularly along these lines? Chancellor Klein in New York, an ally of yours on many educational causes, I believe, has instituted this, regime of many, many standardized, if not tests, assessments throughout the school year leading up to the standardized tests that count. Is that whole thing founded on a lie?
No, what I advocate is I think we actually can overtest, and I worry about overtesting. I worry about bad tests.
Are we overtesting in New York?
I'm not familiar enough with the details there. What I think is important is that you have an annual test, but I think along the way you have what are called evaluations, not high stakes, but real-time data, so that teachers, again, and students and parents know strengths and weaknesses. And what you're seeing in many places around the country now, including New York, is teachers are getting their hands on data that they never had before. And so it helps them differentiate instruction. It helps them drive great teaching. And that is very, very important. So to me, it's not about over-testing. It's about having good evaluations throughout the course of a year so students know their strengths and weaknesses.
But really, my question was about the quality of the tests. Have you looked at particular state tests or city tests? Do you have an opinion about the New York or New Jersey tests and how much they are a lie?
I don't know them intimately. I will tell you that my benchmark are the NAEP results. That's the national results. And very few states have NAEP results that compare to state results. State results in most places are artificially high, and I would argue that would be true in New York and New Jersey as well.
If we have national standards...
International standards.
If we have national standards that conform to international standards, do we need national curricula and teaching methods? Will we get bogged down in the old debates over whether it's better to teach reading through phonics or whole language and all of that?
Yeah. I don't think we need that. It's really interesting. What I think is, again, we need these internationally benchmarked standards, a very high bar that we're all shooting for. I think you need really good assessment, so we're all measuring the same thing.
Then let teachers and school systems get there any way they choose?
Exactly. Let them be creative. Let them innovate. The best ideas are never going to come from Washington. The best ideas for education are always going to come to the local level. And if you have that level of innovation and creativity, you want to hold people accountable for results, but you want to give people the chance to shoot at that high bar in whatever way they think best works. And then as a country, we will learn what are the most effective teaching methods.
How about the content of curriculum or the content of teaching methods? If there's one thing you could change immediately about the way children are being educated today in America, what would it be?
I would go for more depth rather than breadth.
More depth rather than breadth.
Yeah. I think we try and do too much, and we don't spend enough time on what's important.
What would you exclude?
I think, you have to really enable students to develop and build their critical thinking skills. They have to be able to, this can't be about filling out bubble tests. This has to be really being able to demonstrate their knowledge and how they come to their conclusions. And if our students can think critically and write and express themselves on paper, they have a chance to be very successful.
And you know, and everybody's going to want me to ask you this question, that standardized testing itself is still controversial because of how central it has become to the school experience. So do you think we've gone too far under No Child Left Behind, or commonly at the local level, to build the school experience around test prep?
I do. I absolutely agree with that. I worry a lot about the narrowing of the curriculum, and what I always tried to push in Chicago was that great teaching, not great test prep, led to great results. And it's a little bit counterintuitive. We tried to get the test prep out of the classroom, and we saw great teachers who were innovative and creative, and guess what? Their children did extraordinarily well on those tests. So, yes, I worry about the loss of art and music and those kinds of things. So I think we have to do, as we go forward and think about NCELB reauthorization, you want to put in place a system, a set of structures that fight against test prep, that fight against the narrowing of the curriculum. We have to give our children a chance to develop their skills, develop their interests, develop their sense of self-esteem, and where those opportunities aren't available, I think we do our children a big disservice.
Why not include standardized tests for something in the arts? Let's say either visual art or music to be included each year along with math and science and language arts.
Well, as you saw, NAEP actually does that now. And so that's something that we can look at and explore.
I think I see a class divide, and tell me if you saw this in Chicago, in attitudes towards standardized testing and sort of the juggernaut that it's become. Upper middle class parents are the most against it because they think it's unnecessary and takes time away from music and art and other enrichment. Working class and poorer families are more open to it because they see the risk of basic failure in their children's schools and they think this is raising the bar. Do you think it breaks down that way?
I think that's a little simplistic. I mean, there's always some truth in those broad statements, but I think it's more complicated than that. I think what we need as a country and what all parents want is they want their child to have a great, well-rounded curriculum. And what we need as a country is we don't need more tests. We need more good tests, and there's a big distinction there. And I think in many places, again, where there's over-testing, whether that's lower income or upper income parents, they're gonna resist that, and I think that makes sense. But I think we need to again be telling the truth to parents, both upper income, lower income, middle income, it doesn't matter, all the way along a child's education journey, so they know exactly where their child stands and what they can do to be more helpful and more supportive.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with the U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan. What was your favorite subject in school?
I liked English. I liked to read and write.
Were you not a math and science kid?
I liked that as well, but not as much.
Was there something, what was your worst, what did you get bad grades in? Anything?
Sitting still.
Sitting still.
That was not my strength.
My son has the same thing. No, I'm kidding. But was there something that a math and science teacher, math or science teacher, could have done looking back to make it a better experience for you?
No, it was interesting. What I found throughout my life, I was lucky to go to great schools and generally have great teachers, not all, but where I did well is where a teacher had a real passion for the subject. It didn't so much matter what it was, it mattered that the teacher cared a lot about it and they were able to transmit that passion to me. Where you had teachers that were more disinterested or just sort of, doing the minimum, regardless of what the subject was, I tended to lose interest. So right or wrong, I was one of those children that tended to sort of thrive and feed off of a teacher's energy and enthusiasm. And when that was strong, I did well, and when that was weak, I didn't do as well.
On Monday at the White House, a New Yorker working to transform urban education was honored. Maybe you were even there. Jeffrey Canada.
I was there, sitting right behind him. one of my heroes.
Founder of the Harlem Children's Zone and a hero to many of us in New York. And for listeners who don't know, they have a remarkable track record for a decade now of getting low-income Harlem kids all the way through high school and into college. And as Jeffrey Canada put it at the White House on Monday, we run an integrated program, meaning the children are able to get their needs met at the program site. You get your health needs met, you get your social services needs met, you get your dietary needs met, your exercise and your academics at that site. Unquote. That's all a quote from Jeffrey Canada. And they're on target to reach more than 10,000 children by 2011 in Central Harlem. So why is there all this debate about what works in urban education? Don't we know what works? And it's the Harlem Children's Zone model, and we just need to apply it everywhere?
We do know what works, and I agree. I don't think we need a lot more studies. What we need is the courage and the political will to do the right thing. What he's done is absolutely remarkable. As you probably know, he's influenced both the president and I, and we want to replicate in 20 places, the Harlem's Children's Zone, and we're funding money in the FY10 budget to start the planning process to do that. What he's done is a couple things, and this is a lot of hard work. This is, doesn't happen overnight. He's created some great schools there, but what he's done is he works with children, as you said, throughout their education continuum. He works with babies. He works with middle school students. He works with high school students. He helps students go on to college. And it's funny, sometimes the president and I get critiqued for having too ambitious, too aggressive agenda. But we think we have to get better at every level, early childhood, K-12, higher ed. We have unprecedented resources, $100 billion for education. But if we simply invest in status quo, we're not going to get where we need to go. We have to have unprecedented reform.
Is it just too expensive to do Harlem Children's Zone as a national template with all of that extra outside the curriculum stuff that he was referring to?
Well, resources matter, and I often say if you think education is expensive, try ignorance. The flip side of what Jeffrey does is he doesn't just ask for resources, he absolutely says, hold us accountable, and if I don't deliver results, fire me. And I think putting yourself on the line and having the courage to do that, and there are things that they haven't done well and they've improved. This is an evolving model, and 5 years, he's better today than he was 5 years ago, and 5 years from now, I think they'll be even better still. So what you need is, yes, you need the resources, but you need to have the courage to hold yourselves accountable, to make no excuses, and to really believe at your heart that every child, doesn't matter how tough the home, doesn't matter how tough the community, every child can be successful if we as adults give them the long-term opportunities, supports, and have the highest of expectations.
How about vocational training and more willingness to recommend vocational training rather than college for some? We did a segment on the show last week around a New York Times article that maybe you saw. It got a lot of people talking about how jobs like welders and electrical linemen are going unfilled right now while college grads are going unemployed. But we don't want to tell anyone that they're not college material. Is this an issue that you're interested in?
It is. And if you've paid a plumber or a carpenter lately, you know they make a pretty good living. They do very well. And as I always talk about, when I talk about these standards, I always talk about common college-ready and career-ready standards. I always put those together. I would argue as a country, we haven't done enough to make sure our students are prepared to do either college or career. And we have to do a much better job in both. And I do think there are many students who can get great jobs. They need some kind of further training. Doesn't have to be a four-year institution. Maybe it's a two-year community college. Maybe it's a trade or vocational technical training. But there are great jobs out there that are never going to be outsourced, that are going unfilled for lack of good workers. And I think, again, this is another one where as a country, I think in the 50s and 60s, we did a much better job in the voc ed world. And somehow, again, it's another place where we just sort of lost our way.
But there was a problem in the 50s and 60s with this, as I'm sure you well know, which is that it was racially discriminatory. And too many black and Latino kids got tracked as not college material. And we certainly don't want to repeat that mistake. I'm sure you don't want to repeat that mistake. So how do you judge who's coming up and who decides who gets the plumbing education and who goes to community college?
Well, I think you have to give all of our students options. And I think, again, we've had this one-size-fits-all mentality, and too often, quite frankly, that size doesn't fit anyone well. And the more we provide a range of options, and maybe someone wants to be a chef, maybe they want to be a carpenter, maybe they want to be an architect. But the more we're exposing children to a variety of different things at a relatively early age, 13, 14, 15 years old, and let them find their way, let them find their passion. And again, I think so often these debates are actually false debates or false dichotomies. As you know, most young people today don't graduate from college in 4 years. They're working part-time, they're working full-time, going to school part-time. And so they have to have a foot in both camp and be able to be successful at both things. So the more we create a smorgasbord of options, let our students find their way, find their passion, they're going to figure out what the right path for them is.
Is there a percentage, do you know the percentage of Americans who have graduated 4 years of college, who have an undergraduate degree? And do you have a target? Do you have a goal?
We do, and it's not my goal. It's the president's goal. The president's drawn a line in the sand. He said by 2020, we want to have the highest percent of college graduates in the world again. We used to have that with flatlined and other folks to pass us by. Today, we're at about 40%. We'd have to get to 60%. So we got some significant work ahead of us, but we're convinced we can get there. And again, I think we have a moral obligation to do this, but I also feel a real economic imperative. We have to educate our way to a better economy.
U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan is my guest for another few minutes here on WNYC at the Aspen Ideas Festival today. No Child Left Behind is intended mostly to bring up the bottom. I think you agree. But what about bringing up the top? I was talking to a participant at Aspen earlier this week who said he hires engineers and 90% of his best applicants, and I don't know if that's a real number, but it's the number he used, are Indian and Asian. Do we need a No Child Left in Mediocrity compared to other countries act?
We definitely need something more aspirational and inspirational. One thing I'm a big believer in is looking not just at raising the bottom, which is important, but I'm a big believer looking at growth and value add and how much are students gaining each year. We absolutely have to raise the bar. And this we could go on for a long time about this, but there are a number of things. Our school year is too short. Our school week is too short. Our school day is too short. Children in India and China are going to school 25, 30% longer than our children. It's not surprising to me that they're coming out better educated. If you spend more time working on any craft, you're going to get better at that. I'm concerned that our children today are at a competitive disadvantage. Our school year is based upon the agrarian economy. Last time I checked, most of our children weren't working in the fields in the summer. And so we have to fundamentally rethink, again, not just our standards and our assessments, but how we educate children and our commitment to giving them what they need to compete in an international economy.
What does that mean? You want students to go to school 12 months a year?
13.
14, 15.
Well, let me explain what I do mean, because this is, in all seriousness, I think schools should be open 12, 13, 14 hours a day, 6-7 days out of the week, 11, 12 months out of the year. I think during the after-school hours, you could have academic enrichment at the core, but you need a variety of other things, drama and art and sports and music and chess and debate and academic decathlon and all those things that give our students a chance to build their interest and build their self-esteem and develop in a healthy way. I think our schools have to be centers of the community, GED classes, ESL, family literacy nights, family counseling. We had about 24 schools at home in Chicago that had healthcare clinics attached to them. Our schools have to be the heart of the community. And this idea of schools being open 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, 9 months out of the year, simply doesn't work anymore. We have to think much more expansively about the role of a school in today's world.
You have to change American culture in order to get there. Because after a certain point, most, I think, middle-class parents in this country are going to say, come on, it's too much. They already say, half the parents say, my kids have too much homework.
Well, I think those are different issues. And actually, this is an issue that I would beg to differ with you. This is an issue to me that cuts through race and class. And whether it's two-parent working families, whether it's single moms working one job or two jobs or sometimes three jobs trying to make ends meet, or whether it's too many of our children going home to, frankly, no-parent families, those hours from 4 o'clock to 7 o'clock are times of high anxiety. Those times in the summer are very, very tough on parents. And let me be clear, you need a variety of options. And if you have a middle-class family where that child in the summer is, you know, going to summer camps and traveling and, you know, visiting colleges, that's fine. You know, more power to them. Let's encourage that. But we have too many students, as you well know, who don't have those kinds of enrichment activities. We've, you know, documented the heartbreaking summer reading loss where children get to a certain point in June and come back to school in the fall and they're further behind when they left. How is that good for children? So we have to be creative. We have to think differently. This isn't one size fits all. But for children that need more, we have to give it to them.
You say you want international standards. And I won't say national anymore because I know you're just going to say international. Is there a country you have in mind as a model?
There are a number of countries that are doing a great job with this. So there's not one. And again, I think I have so much confidence in our students. And if we give them a chance to compete, if we level the playing field, I think our children will compete and outcompete people anywhere. So we want to raise standards with the best around the world. So there are many places that are interesting that we're looking at. Singapore is one of those. But there's not one model that we think, you know, we want to be like that. I think we should have higher aspirations than that. This is really our moonshot. We should aim to be better than anybody else.
And how about our teachers? I interviewed Randy Weingarten, the American Federation of Teachers Union president, this week, and I told her I was going to talk to you, and I asked her, what's the one toughest question you have for Arne Duncan? And here's what she said.
My toughest question for Arne Duncan is, how is he going to absolutely ensure that there are voices of teachers on an everyday basis in the new accountability paradigm?
What do you say to Randy Weingarten?
I absolutely agree. I have tremendous respect for her. I think she's going to do a great, great job. She did a great job leading New York's teachers. I think she's going to do a phenomenal job at the national level. It is critically important that all this change, all this reform we're talking about, it cannot happen to teachers. It has to happen with teachers and for teachers. And I had a set of teachers that advised me every single year in Chicago. They were hugely influential in helping me, you know, determine my strategy and philosophy. I'm traveling the country on this listening and learning tour and talking to teachers in rural areas, in suburban, in urban. The teacher voice is hugely important. And I promise Randy and every teacher around the country that their voice is going to be extraordinarily important to me as we move forward.
If our standards for students are too low enough that it becomes a lie, are our teachers' standards, our standards for teachers, also too low?
I think, frankly, we have to challenge everybody. We have to challenge our students. We absolutely have to challenge our teachers. We have to challenge our principals. We have to challenge our school board members.
Are they getting away with too much? Is Randy Weingarten's union getting away with too little accountability now?
It's not that anyone's getting away with something. Again, as a country, we have to get dramatically better, and we have to do it with a real sense of urgency. And I always say the definition of insanity is continuing to do the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. If we're serious about, again, leading the world in the percent of college graduates, if we're serious about educating our way to a better economy, we all have to do more. We all have to challenge each other to work harder and to work in a better collaborative way. And that's everyone. Again, parents, students, teachers, principals, school board members, mayors, governors, the Department of Education, all of us have to step up and do more.
Last thing. I come from a city with out of current education governance structure right now because of the stalemate in the state Senate. Presumably it'll go back to mayoral control, but right now things are so messed up in Albany, it's anybody's guess. Do you endorse mayoral control of schools, a more independent school board, or does it just depend on the city?
I absolutely, particularly in a place like New York that's seen so much progress with mayoral control, to walk away from this now would make absolutely no sense to me. New York's public schools have come a long way. As you well know, they have a long, long way to go. I don't think in big, complicated cities where these problems are so difficult, so intractable, that school systems can do this by themselves. You need the entire city rallied behind this effort. You need the philanthropic community, the religious community, the business community, the nonprofits, the social service agencies. You need all the sister governmental agencies working together, police, fire, parks and rec, children and family services. The only way you get that kind of collective leadership and everyone pushing in the right direction is with mayoral control. I think Mayor Bloomberg has done a tremendous job. Has he done everything perfectly? Of course not. But the New York public schools today are much better thanks to his leadership, and to walk away from that would make no sense whatsoever to me.
U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan, appointed by President Obama, thank you so much for sitting with us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll talk to the former Assistant U.S. Attorney General, Viet Dinh. We are coming to you from the Aspen Ideas Festival today, so you can go to our website, WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. You can see some of our photos from Aspen, and check out my Twitter feed. Stay with us.